Hi, welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast. I'm your host, Rupesh Patel, and I just had a great conversation with Captain Gary Russell, a pilot with over 25 years of experience that currently flies for Air Canada. You know, safety has been in the minds of many people these days when it comes to the airline aviation industry. We just heard about that crazy incident of Alaska Airlines where the door just blows out. How does that even happen? And what's the role of the airline in that situation? Gary and I get into that. We talk about the struggles that are happening at Boeing. What does that mean for the aerospace giant? And what does that mean for Airbus and other manufacturers for that matter? We talk about the labor shortages with pilots and the effect of diversity and inclusion training. Is that compromising safety in any way? I mean, it's an easy conversation to have for many people. So we get into all this. It's a fascinating conversation. Gary's a very logical, sensible person. And I think you're going to find this episode pretty awesome. So like, subscribe, and enjoy the show. Cheers.
Welcome to the Two Nobodies podcast with my dad.
Gary, my brother, good to see you. I'm so glad that you're back.
I'm happy to be back. I've been counting the days for this meeting. We've been planning on the books there for, I guess, a couple of months now. So yeah, I'm happy to be back.
And you're looking sharp. You're not looking like a cowboy anymore.
Well, yeah, it's a look. It's an outfit. So I gave you cowboy last time. This is, I don't know, this is off-duty airline pilot, maybe.
Yeah.
So I'll do another costume next time. We'll figure out what that looks like.
Well, I think it contributes to like some of the comments I got from the one clip that just, you know, people seem to be really interested in was your thoughts on MH370 and the,
yes,
the comments. People were just like, is this guy even a pilot? Like, I don't even know.
I saw that one. Yeah. So I thought, well, maybe this time around I'll wear my full uniform hat and really prove. But we've got some restrictions, you know, being such a public figure, we're really not supposed to wear our uniform unless we're on duty as an airline pilot. So I gave you this, and you can see some of our, actually off to my right, you can see one of the models there of the aircraft that I fly, which happens to be the 737 MAX, which I'm sure we'll talk about today.
Yes, we will definitely talk about the MAX. I don't know, like one of the things I really appreciate about the last conversation was that you gave people like just the straight goods of like what it, like from your perspective as a pilot, just really logical, sensible answers. And so I'm hoping that we can dive into different topics, and I know that'll come out as well, but I know people appreciate that. But on the MH370, like, you know, people were saying all kinds of, like, even though you said all these things, it's just so funny sometimes reading the comments. Like, I'll get these random comments on other videos where I know they just haven't watched it. And mm-hmm. that certainly came out on some of the comments for that one clip. But yeah, there's a lot going on right now, a lot of safety related things. There's a lot of, like, you know, Boeing just feels like it's in trouble again, and then, you know, obviously I'm curious about on the pilot front, like how that laid on the labor side, because you certainly have good insights about that, how that's going. But what's on your mind right now when it comes to the airline aviation industry?
I mean, for us, it's a little bit different when you're in it, because our job is so focused on, you know, arriving at the airport, going through all of our usual checks, looking at weather, looking at the route, you know, preparing for flight. You tend to tune a lot of that stuff out. And it's more when your friends and family are saying, hey, have you heard about this, you know, this piece or this news or this huge, you know, issue? I mean, we do read the newspaper, we do watch, you know, news online or on TV. So sometimes it feels like you're playing catch up a little bit. And I know we were back and forth getting ready for this conversation, just doing a little bit of review on some of the news around Boeing. So yeah, there is a lot happening. We can dive right into it. I would say, first of all, like first and foremost, being a pilot on the MAX, you know, when I go to work and I go through all those checks and I sit in that cockpit, you know, there's no part of me that's not completely confident that I'm in a safe aircraft, or that I wouldn't send my family. You know, my wife just traveled on a MAX, you know, earlier this week. So I know there's a lot of news and a lot of emotion around the brand and the aircraft itself, just because it's in the news so often. But with that, with Boeing and with the 737 MAX in particular, I think it's helpful to just kind of put it in a little bit of a framework. You know, I was looking at how many are in service or had been produced. There's over 10,000 of these things that have been produced. There's another 7,000 that are on order. And then when you do that mental math, there's at any given moment, there's on average 1,000 of these things that are airborne at any given moment. Mm-hmm. And that means every 5 seconds, there's two 737s either taking off or landing. So all that gives you a little bit of context to say, yes, there's really significant news coming out of Boeing and relating to the 737. But on the flip side of that, it's one of the, if not the most popular airliner on the planet, and flies many thousands of hours safely. And I don't meet any crews that are concerned or hesitant about hopping into that flight deck. And, you know, it's considered a very reliable aircraft. As an operator, you know, our airline would put it at the top of the pile as far as overall reliability. Mm-hmm. So that's to frame our conversation, to say, yeah, if we're going to talk about Boeing and 737, you know, there has to be sort of that conversation to say, you know, it is part of the air transport system in Canada and globally. And I think most pilots, if not all of us, when we hop in, we don't go anywhere unless we feel we're safe.
What makes the 737 MAX like special in the sense of like, why did they even move to develop that? Like, compared to, I guess there would have been a regular 737, I would imagine. Like, what's so unique about the 737 MAX that made it attractive for airlines to want to purchase?
So there's a whole story that you can really unpack going back to, you know, when Boeing was founded 100 years ago. But somewhere down the line, they produced the 737. I think it was late 60s was the first iteration of that design. Which, you know, filled this niche market or this growing sector of sort of shorter to medium haul jets. Mm. Most jets were 4 or 3 engine before that. This was a twin engine jet and became immensely popular. So when we look at the modern 737, it has its lineage that goes all the way back to the 60s, which, you know, some people may say, well, this thing's ancient. Well, it is a testament to Boeing's design philosophy and the way that Boeing was founded as a very engineering-centric company and a safety-centric company. So when you get into that airplane, it's very overbuilt. It's got redundancies on every system, which you some of those redundancies you wouldn't even find in modern airliners designed today. So the reason for the 737 MAX and that it's not a brand new design really comes from Airbus producing their version of a narrow body, which is called the 320neo. New engine design, very efficient, hits the market, and Boeing sort of sees their competition really increase through this offering. Mm. And Airbus was producing an aircraft that not only had great fuel efficiency, but incredible range, so opens up new markets. For a single aisle aircraft. And I think you can see it in the analysis, is that Boeing looked at, you know, what's it going to take for us to clean sheet a new aircraft to compete with the 320neo versus can we put, you know, this next generation of engines on our existing airframe? And it's also worth noting that, you know, there's some big customers out there like Southwest that, if you give them an option to say, we'll give you your current fleet type with a more efficient engine, you don't have to retrain your pilots, or we're going to design an entirely new aircraft that would require new certification and new pilot training, they're going to take what they have and say, hey, we'll take a current 737 that's more efficient. So, you know, it came to market as sort of the last iteration of the 737 MAX. Certainly the next single aisle that Boeing offers will be a new design. I think most observers feel that aircraft's you know, been tweaked as much as possible. And with all the news surrounding it, I think the brand's taken a beating. So I can't imagine Boeing, you know, continuing on with another iteration of the MAX, but certainly the aircraft is very efficient as a pilot on the MAX. You know, it's incredibly fuel efficient, great range. And like I said earlier, it continues to be very reliable despite the news and the things that have happened. We can kind of dig into why those events are significant for Boeing at least.
So, and what I'm hearing, the big difference is that it's just the engines are different. Essentially, the body is the same.
Is that... Yeah, and anybody who watched, you know, there was a really, I felt it was an interesting insight that Netflix did a documentary on the MAX, looked at, you know, why those accidents happened. There was obviously two fatal accidents with that type. Long story short, when you put a new engine or a bigger engine on an existing airframe, the aerodynamics change. And that's when you got MCAS and some of these other modifications that were, you know, not visible to the flight crew, weren't disclosed by Boeing right away. And this is well documented. This is not new information, but they had to change the flight characteristics. And the way they did that was through software. You know, the original engines, if you look at historical photos from the 60s and 70s, very tiny profile on those engines. If you look at it from the front, very skinny inlets compared to the today's wide chord engines, and just a different design philosophy. They call it high bypass. So a lot more air going through the front changes the way the airplane flies.
Okay. So you start off this conversation saying, like, you know, you feel as a flight, like as a captain, and then you talk to other flight crews, like no one really has an issue with flying the MAX. Right. And even last time when we talked, I felt very reassured about like the safety protocols that you folks take on the airline that you work, but you said that's very similar across the industry, particularly here in Canada, but I imagine on many other airlines. I felt really reassured about that. But it feels like the difference, like on something like that happened recently on the Alaska Airlines incident or whatever, it's that how much is it the airline versus how much is it the actual like manufacturer, right? Like how much do you account for? Like how do could you have even predicted something like that was going to happen, right? Like you do all your checks, but like at the end of the day, if the actual manufacturing is flawed, like that's not something that you can really account for, could you?
No, but and I think we talked about this last time in our first conversation together. We talked about, I think, if I'm remembering it correctly, the Swiss cheese model, and that's how we look at safety in the airline world. It's an older model, but it still works. So when you look at preventing an incident or an accident, you've got all these layers of safety, and it would start from, you know, the legal framework around the jurisdiction. So FAA, Transport Canada, you've got all these rules, the manufacturer builds an airplane, they've got rules around their certification, and then you start to build the airplane. So you've got all kinds of quality control and safety management systems to make sure that product is produced in a certain way. Then the product gets certified. That's got its, you know, its hurdles to meet and its certification benchmarks to meet as they roll an aircraft out. And then it actually goes to the flight line. You start putting passengers on, and the airline has all these checks and balances. We've got protocols right from when the airline takes delivery of an aircraft, the inspections that happen at that point, the ongoing maintenance, you know, the training that we get as pilots. So all of these safety layers are there even before the passengers arrive at the airport. Mm-hmm. And even then, once you board the aircraft, we've got sensors, we've got inspections, we've got walkarounds, we've got all these ways to trap issues that of course, human beings involved in any system can introduce problems or introduce errors. The whole game is trap those errors. And if you've got enough layers of safety, and you can even, in Boeing's case, include company culture and the board of directors in that safety, that Swiss cheese model. And we call it the Swiss cheese model because if you slice pieces of Swiss cheese, they all have holes in them, which would represent an error or an opportunity for an error to get through. But if you put enough pieces of Swiss cheese in a line, eventually you're going to block that error. And usually it happens early on. And we'd like it to happen, you know, obviously in the production phase of an aircraft, but there's other places that you can catch those errors. And, you know, I think the other thing you can sort of remember about aviation is we have a culture of learning from our mistakes. We don't hide our mistakes. So if there is something that gets through that Swiss cheese, we go back and say, hey, what's this telling us about our process, our procedures, our manufacturing, our training? Let's go back and either introduce another layer or improve that one layer of safety earlier in the process.
Okay.
So, and I don't remember what your original question was, but we were talking about, you know, what is this, you know, what does this incident tell us? And I think that's the deeper question about Boeing.
Yeah. Well,
or these incidents.
Well, I think it was, like I said, I felt very assured that, like, as a flight crew, the safety protocols that you took, like, I remember you saying, like, there's a before and after the fact, like, if there's anything you guys are reporting that you, there's, yeah, there's just layers of safety that you folks have built in terms of your operations. But I think it was just wondering, like, okay, if it's a manufacturer piece, then how would you even, like, how would you even know that, okay, something's, like, for example, on the Alaska Airlines thing. And first of all, I think, you know, I imagine people are also thinking, okay, this is one incident that happened. You know, there's obviously other incidents that happened, but, like, the airline industry is a very safe industry. But when it comes to, like, the door got blown out, right? Like, the bolts weren't in there, and they're finding, and you just talked about, like, the layers of safety. Like, how does that, if the manufacturer is delivering on this, then the airline actually does their own check on these things. This wasn't a plane that just, it was our first flight, right? This particular plane, I think, was manufactured sometime in the early fall or something like that. It had gone through a number of hours of flying. And so it would have gone through many, you know, you, based on your model, what you described, it would have went through a number of safety checks. So I just, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm sure people still feel comfortable flying, but it's just, this one just feels weird because it's like, how do you,
this, yeah, this one is, and again, it's like I mentioned there that, anytime there is an incident, we want to look at what happened, what can we learn from it?
Yeah,
and I think that's where we're going with this conversation. But, for those that aren't familiar with what happened recently, Alaskan was, I think it was a departure out of Portland PDX. They were in the climb out and a door plug. So it's not a door that they would use on that particular, at that particular airline, but it is a plug that's an optional exit door, whether it's for a different seat configuration and you can put an exit there, or it's for a maintenance function. That part I don't know, but the plug itself it blew out, the aircraft depressurized, the crew returned to land safely in Portland. Obviously very disturbing for anybody on board, but no fatalities. And I'm not aware of any injuries, but again, that part of the report I didn't look at. What I was looking at for this conversation was, you know, where the FAA is at in their investigation. It sounds like the plug itself, when it was delivered as part of the fuselage, and what you have to remember about Boeing or Airbus or any large aircraft manufacturer is all the pieces of the airplane come together in Seattle or Wichita or wherever the aircraft is assembled, or Toulouse, but other contract manufacturers often produce the wing pieces or the fuselage or the engine, and they all come together at Airbus or at Boeing. That means you've got to really have a integrated production process to make sure that, okay, this fuselage arrives, it's the right fuselage, it's manufactured to the proper standard, and that it fits with all the other parts. That in itself is challenging. So Spirit AeroSystems is the company that produced the fuselage for the 737 MAX. From what I can tell in the FAA's initial report, and again, this isn't a final report, is the Boeing did have a process to identify problems with that plug. There was an issue with the bolts. So they said to Spirit on site, you've got to remove this plug, fix the bolts, and replace it. Somewhere in that process, as that defective part was removed, worked on, and replaced, the bolts that hold it in properly, and any door on our aircraft sits on hard stands. It can't blow out just you know, on its own. But if there's movement, if there's shear forces, yes, it can move and blow out as it did leaving Portland. The point being that that plug was identified as faulty or had having issues, was removed by Spirit and put back on the airplane. The big question now becomes, you've got two companies involved. Who is responsible for identifying the defect? Obviously Boeing, but who is responsible to put it back on the airplane properly and make sure that the bolts are returned? Now, in the end, yes, it's a Boeing product. Boeing is responsible. Spirit's a subcontractor, but in that process of two separate companies on the shop floor, on the production line, if a default is identified, I think that's where the conversation and the investigation is going to focus, at least in that, you know, in that SMS or safety management conversation. Mm-hmm. There's a bigger conversation about why is this happening? Why did this happen on a Boeing? Why did the previous accidents also happen on a Boeing on this particular aircraft? Is it the manufacturer? Is it the culture? Mm. Is it the design of the aircraft? Now you're starting to get, you know, into the bigger conversation about what happened to this manufacturer. Yeah. And there's lots of analysis going on in that realm as well.
Yeah. Hey, if you were flying that aircraft at the time, door blows out, things depressurized, like what's the feeling like as the pilot in that situation? Like what happens to, like, what are you feeling on your end? And like, how do you handle that situation?
So I think any professional can relate to this, whether you're in medicine or first responder, anybody that's done a lot of training on emergency situations will describe this. And I've had failures on board as well, engine problems, hydraulic losses. You've got so much training drilled into you that your first reaction is actually quite calm. Okay, we've got this indication and all your training comes flooding in. You certainly get a little bit of an adrenaline boost there, but I would say most people I've talked to that have had failures are all in agreement that your training kicks in. Mm. Okay, we've got a loss of cabin pressurization or rapid depressurization issue. That for us on the 737 across airlines is a memory item. So we don't even use a checklist. We just roll right into our script, and it's a script we practice every single flight. So when we get in the cockpit, we do all our checks, program the aircraft. The last thing we do before we go flying is rehearse our lines together on what are we going to do if there's an engine failure, severe damage to the engines, and a rapid depressurization. So, and there's a few other ones that we review as well when we're flying, but those are the ones that we do without fail. Any flight that we do it before we take off. So that crew would have rehearsed that. And so through 10,000 or wherever it happened, they would have just gone right into their script. And that would involve, you know, seating the flight attendants. The flight attendants also have their scripts. So even if they couldn't hear exactly what the crew was saying, they'd be strapping in, making sure all the passengers are secure. We'd be turning on all kinds of external lights. We would be setting a lower altitude, making a turn to get ourselves away from other traffic. There's a whole sequence of things that we would just be doing. And even if you can't hear the other pilot, if there's wind noise or whatever, and I know passengers were describing that, you know exactly what that other person's doing. You've rehearsed it so many times. Yeah. And then once you're down to a safe altitude, safe airspeed, and you can pull up a paper checklist, cross-check what you've done, and recover the airplane, the whole process maybe takes 10 or 15 minutes max.
Does it make it really hard to fly in a depressurized situation?
It does. It depends on what altitude you were at,
okay,
the damage to the aircraft. You know, in the case of the Alaskan flight, that plug's quite a ways aft. So the flight deck.
What does that mean?
Well, the actual hole or the plug that was that blew out was so far behind the pilots, who have a bulletproof door that's closed and locked, they may not have even noticed any sound difference. Certainly they would have noticed that the cabin depressurized, because you know you can feel and hear that. But they may have been able to still talk to each other depending on what the altitude was. Either way, they would have had oxygen masks on.
Okay.
And they can talk to each other through the microphones in the oxygen mask. That creates a little bit of a communications challenge because you can't hear the person as well as when you're just speaking to them back and forth. So that's why the checklist and the drill is so important. Even if I can't hear exactly what you're saying, I know what you're saying because we've practiced it.
Yeah.
When you're
speaking to your training, like you go right to the, like you said, you just jump to this space where you would have trained this over and over again. What are those, like, I don't know, what are some extreme scenarios that you guys would have had to rehearse or practice? And like, what's the frequency of that? Like, I imagine there's all kinds of scenarios that you guys are always, that you rehearsing or practicing, right?
Most of the scenarios we rehearse, you will not see in a 30-year career.
Okay.
It's just not, it's not likely. And these events don't happen enough that pilots see them. So, you know, I've been flying for a major airline for 17 or 18 years, and I've had one or two instances where I've had to pull out a checklist, which would mean, hey, there's a systems problem that's significant enough that we need to shut something down, or we're going to have to recalculate our fuel burn. Totally. Wouldn't be noticeable by the passengers at all. It's not an engine failure. It's not a gear failure. It's not a fire, nothing like that. There's systems that have redundancy. So, you know, we might advise the passengers, hey, you might notice this, or you might hear this, this change, because we're going to turn off a certain system, or a certain system is moved to its backup, just so that there's no panic. People are very sensitive to sounds and feelings. And if they notice anything different, you know, they want to hear from the crew. But in 17 years, you know, no engine failures, no gear problems, no fires. It's you know, knock on wood, it can happen. Of course, we train for it. But the systems become so safe that most airline pilots in their career will not have a significant failure or an emergency.
If you train the more extreme scenarios, then does that essentially mean that you could handle the kind of, you know, non-extreme scenarios?
Back to our Swiss cheese model, right? Yeah, it's like, sometimes that's the final layer of safety.
Yeah.
If those Alaskan pilots weren't trained, that plug failure could have been way worse.
Yeah.
And that's really why we put those layers in. Hey, you know, it's not likely we're going to have an engine fire or a rapid depressurization. It's extremely unlikely, but you train like it's going to happen because it's that layer of that final, or it's one of the final layers of safety. Obviously you don't want manufacturing defaults or defects, but we have to layer in that safety just in case.
Yeah. I want to get back to Boeing eventually, but I wanted to focus on this training front. Something that's come up, I don't know, good or bad, but it's come up a lot in the mainstream is like diversity inclusion training and the effect that's having, and whether that's been positive or whether that's, in some people's mind, been negative. And I shared something with you a few days ago, but, you know, conservative commentary's got a pretty big following. Matt Walsh did this whole thing on diversity inclusion training has something to do with, you know, some of these incidents, and, you know, there's less of a focus on safety and having the best people up there flying these aircraft. And it's really about prioritizing, you know, diversity and inclusion. So just curious about like, diversity, inclusion, the role it's playing in terms on the labor front. And I don't know if you have any thoughts on that opinion perhaps, but.
I didn't get a chance to watch the one that you were referring to, but I had seen other, you know, there's comedians that have made this kind of a bit. And, you know, I think it's important to, again, frame this properly. So traditionally, airline pilots, overwhelmingly male, overwhelmingly white, present company included. And I think airlines are starting to acknowledge, look, we are serving all these communities. We want our employees to look like the communities that we're serving. I'd also say, you know, airline pilot, great job. It's like any other profession. It's got its challenges, but it's very rewarding. So I think you're seeing airlines like United, like Air Canada, and others say, hey, we want to be intentional about including different people groups into our employees. And that includes airline pilots, engineers, all of those very high quality jobs. So I think we can all agree that, you know, bringing everyone into great jobs is a good thing. That's mm-hmm. just a motherhood and apple pie statement. And then, you know, I think it's also helpful to look at what this profession is. So we've already been talking about some of the dimensions of aviation. It's one of the most highly regulated industries, if not the most on the planet. It has all of these very quantitative hurdles that you have to pass. And for a pilot included, you know, to get a license, it's not a qualitative assessment based on how you look or mm-hmm. or the kind of person that the airlines might want. You literally have to have, you know, be able to make the field in an engine failure. You have to demonstrate that you can maintain an altitude within mm-hmm. a very hard number. You have mm-hmm. to be able to do all of these exercises, and it's not an examiner looking at the person I said qualitative, but they're not looking at, hey, is this guy a good pilot or not? Or is this girl a good pilot? Or is this person a good pilot? They're literally looking at, in this event set, did they maintain altitude within that bracket? Yeah. Did they complete all the checklists?
Those are
yes, no answers.
So
to say that, and I don't want to dismiss that there's all the soft skills that we have as professionals, the way that we relate to each other, you mm-hmm. know, crew resource management is becoming even more important than ever. And that's kind of a $10 word to say problem solving in the cockpit. And everybody has a different style, fair enough. But even those event sets, when we go into the simulator together, are packaged and have certain goals that have to be met. So if you and I are flying together, we can solve a complex problem in different ways, but to pass the simulator session, we must have a certain outcome. And so for anybody to say, you know, that the person that airlines are going out and finding a certain look of person or a certain type of person to fill, you know, their quotas.
The quotas, yeah.
It just doesn't really align with how aviation actually works. Yes, I think it's important that we acknowledge that there's an imbalance. We've got to address that, but it's at the recruitment stage that's going to happen, and people won't get through all those stages of training and qualification unless they're true professionals, unless they're qualified. Yeah. And you're not going to see anybody in a flight deck that's not qualified. The airline has no mechanism to go out and say, hey, we want to improve our DEI numbers, so we're just going to go get, you know, people that look a certain way. No, it doesn't work that way. Like we have such strict standards, and then you've got to go out and get your hours. So our hour requirements, you know, you have to have thousands of hours, and you have to have command time, and you have to have, you know, all these licenses to even apply. So that is.
Is there any
most pilots?
Yeah.
Maybe not obvious to the public.
Is there any prioritization in hiring though for racialized minorities or you know, if they have all the technical qualifications, they're able to hit those basic yes and no's, as you said. Is there prioritization for hiring in that sense though?
I think currently I can, and I don't know what the airline's hiring standards look like for hiring. If there's a tendency towards filling those DEI, I don't want to say quotas because they're not. We're deficient right now. We're really just trying to catch up, and I think it's worth saying that out loud. There's such a global shortage of pilots right now that I think it's difficult for airlines to say, hey, we're going to pick only a certain people group because we want to address these DEI shortfalls. Certainly in Canada and the US, and I think globally as well, they're just trying to get as many people into the airline as they can.
Yeah.
So I think the only way to address the issue is really to start at the recruitment level. And you're seeing that in the US, to a certain extent in Canada, saying, you know, how do we get young Aboriginal kids involved in aviation? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of barriers to entry for a kid that's growing up in the North.
Totally.
You know, finance might be one of them.
Yeah.
Seeing other pilots that look like them. So I think it's a big project. We're not going to be, there's no band-aid solution. Anybody that's accusing the airlines of, you know, going out and hiring massive amounts of visible minorities or women, even if the airline wanted to do that, it's just not possible. There's not that pool of candidates, and they're short already, right? But I would say that if they're serious about it, any organization serious about DEI, they've got to look at it holistically. And for aviation, we have to figure out what the barriers are for women, people of color, minority, sexual orientation, and make sure that A, they can see themselves in the uniform, B, that there's enough resources for them to go pursue that career. And we all know that, racialization comes with all kinds of other issues, and financial issues are one of them. So, you know, I think you can, a legitimate critique of the airlines is to say, and certainly the regulator and the public, is to say, what are we doing to actually get these people in the training pipeline so that as fast as possible, when the airlines are looking for candidates, that the candidate pool looks like Canada, or looks like the US, or looks like the community that they're flying to.
I agree with, like, candidates being able to see themselves in the uniform, especially if there's no models or examples. Like, I think I can see there's a lot of importance in there. I do wonder about when you said airlines are thinking about, okay, ensuring that their flight crews are kind of representative of the people that are actually the customers and the patrons that are on their aircraft. I don't know. I wonder if that's really a thing for customers and patrons. For me, do I really care who's in the flight deck? Like, as long as I know they can do the job, I don't know if I really care, to be honest. Right. Like, I just want to make sure that they're competent as hell. Right. Like, so, yeah.
And that's, I guess, what I'm trying to say is this, the aviation system that we've built globally, and I'd say put on top of that, our seniority-based system, it is a good vehicle for diversity. If we can get diverse candidates starting into a career in aviation, whether they're an engineer, a pilot, a dispatcher, I mean, we've got dozens of professions that are high quality jobs that should be of interest to anybody that's got some intelligence and some capacity to do the work. So I think I hear what you're saying. It's more of a societal question. I think we're starting to answer that as a country to say, you know, diversity is important for all these reasons. We don't want to leave people groups out. I think, you know, comedians and commentators have grabbed onto that and said, well, you know, safety's first. Well, of course, safety first. Safety is always first. The system is built for safety. What we're saying is, you know, do we as a culture and as a society prioritize, more equality in the higher ranks of our workforce? And I think that's a question that it's not a safety question. That's like a human question.
Yeah.
So we're starting to answer those. I'm not sure everybody's on board yet, but
no, they're not. That's for sure. I think you make a good
point.
It
doesn't sound like it.
No.
What's that?
I think you make a good point in terms of the system is built for safety. I think people need to be reassured that that's the case sometimes. Like, I think people think that, all these hires are happening and we're compromising safety at the same time. But you just spelled out, you know, exactly how it works, right? In terms of how, there's basic things that people need to be able to do. There's all this training that needs to happen. It's not just because you look a certain way that you automatically get the job, right? Like, I don't know why people all of a sudden feel like like the system is failing. Maybe it's just mistrust in general in systems these days as a whole. And so people feel like, okay, all these kind of cultural things are taking precedence over basic systems, but you just really articulated like, no, the system is still there. It's yeah.
And I would flip this argument back on the critics of DEI initiatives. And this is just conversations I've had with friends that are pilots and also happen to be part of a visible minority or women. So both underrepresented groups in our profession. And everybody's got a different take on this. So I'm not trying to like put everybody in the same container here, but in discussion with a few of my friends, one conversation in particular I had with my friend Kathy, she was saying, you know, as a woman in a male-dominated career, my whole goal is to make sure that people see me as a pilot first. So often, you know, she's conscious of the fact that, and it shouldn't be this way, but it is, that she's had to be extra conscious about any little error I might make or something that I might miss. It's not good to miss anything as a pilot, but that also reflects on my gender.
Yeah.
And I think equally some folks that are professional pilots that also happen to be part of a minority group may also have that in the back of their mind that are saying, look, I got to be on my A game, my extra A game, because I'm carrying the profession, but I'm also carrying my group here.
100%.
And so you could make the argument that these are actually better pilots in some ways. It's not, I don't think people should go to work that way. Nobody should have to carry that burden. But the reality is when you talk to some of these folks, this can be their thought process. The goal is to get away from that. Obviously you shouldn't go to work and trying to be carrying that with you. And also as a profession, we got to make sure that culture goes away, which I think there is a push certainly in our association to move away from that, to really show, hey, this is an inclusive profession, but it is going to take time. I don't know if there's a way to fast track it. And it's really, it's a function of those safety protocols, but it's also a function of the global shortage of airline pilots. So anybody that's accusing airlines of like cherry picking people, it's like, I don't think so. We're so short that, you know, once you meet those qualifications, we want you, we want you in those flight decks.
Listen, I can relate to a lot of that. I was born in this country, have two master's degrees. But when you grow up and people are constantly like, oh, you actually speak the language really well, or I didn't know that, you know, you understand these things about Canadian culture, whatever it might be, you know, I'm in an interracial marriage and, you know, we got a lot of looks in the beginning. Right. And we've been together for God, it's almost 17 years, right? Like
but seems backwards,
but we still get those looks. And so I've always had this, even though I don't really need to anymore, pretty established in my career, but there's still times where I feel like I gotta overperform because I am carrying this feeling of like I gotta represent this community, right? Even though like I, again, born here, I wasn't born in India, you know, but I still feel like I'm representing a certain community to some extent, and I gotta work extra hard. So I can 100% appreciate that feeling of those examples that you gave. It sucks. You don't want to have to work like that.
It's not my experience. It's just what we've got time in the flight deck to talk about this stuff.
Sometimes
it comes to the surface, and it's, you know, the people that are close to me have shared that with me. And I think also looking at it, you know, my former life as a union leader for over 10 years, we would see opportunities to, something as simple as allowing beards. We didn't used to allow beards, and it really came up because one of our professional colleagues, who also happened to be he was Sikh, so he's like, look, I'm getting married, I'm gonna be the only guy not sporting facial hair. And so we looked at it. It took a bit of a process to do the testing, had to make sure the oxygen masks worked. We looked at beard length, we looked at a bunch of different things. But for a white pilot, it's like, well, this is great. I get to, you know, because of the work and, you know, my buddy who just happens to be Sikh putting his hand up and saying, hey, we should be able to have beards it's important for me culturally. I'm the odd one out when I go to this wedding if I don't have my beard. And we actually went a step further because some of our Indian pilots were looking at headdresses, and also we have a few folks that from different religious backgrounds that share that desire to have a headdress at work. So now we have protocols for headdress as well. So you can wear your headdress, you can wear your beard. Those are very small wins, but I think, you know, that's an area where I think you've got to create the space in your DEI protocols to look at, all right, how do we include these people in a way that's not just putting them all into the traditional box? Doesn't mean you can do everything. An oxygen mask may not fit if your beard is gigantic. So there's a balance there. But I think you can make it work with the right approach. And if everybody's kind of pulling in the same direction.
Listen, I'm sure there's airlines in India where they're, you know, you have Punjabi men who are having to deal with those situations and they make it work, right? Like,
yeah. And I don't know what Air India's protocols are. Like, I don't know if they even allow that. So, you know, it was something that we were actually able to pull from the Canadian military. They had an established dress code already for folks that either wear a beard or a headdress or both. So it made it easier for us to bring that into Air Canada. And it was, look, the company was open to it. Sometimes you just needed someone to put up their hand because we, you know, we tend to have our blind spots. And it's I think that's a frustrating part for minorities is they're constantly having to help, you know, the majority group understand what it is that's needed. That's another thing that I think we've got to work on is looking around, being more aware of, okay, how do we make this still a professional space to work, but also make sure everybody's got their voice in that space. So it's constant work.
I mean, I don't want to speak for I don't represent everybody on this, but I know for me, like, I don't mind raising awareness about certain things. I understand that it's part of change, and people don't, awareness is a part of it. You know, building that knowledge is a huge piece of it. Helping them, helping create desire for that change. Like, I'm happy to play that role. It's if people are like, what bothers me is if there's no openness towards it. And I think that would probably be, that would probably affect maybe people. So for someone to put up their hand and say, hey, I'd like to keep my beard because I'm, you know, going to get married. And I don't want, you know, I don't know how your friend felt in that situation, but I know for me, I'd be like, yeah, I don't mind saying that as long as folks are willing to kind of hear me out. But if I'm going to get resistance towards it, especially in this day and age, like, that'd be very discouraging, I think.
I think professional norms are a difficult barrier sometimes. You don't want to be the person that's putting their hand up and saying, hey, this needs to change. Change is hard. And so I think that it is challenging when there's a lot, and aviation in particular, the professional pilots have a lot of norms. So if you're going to try and shift that, it's a huge challenge. And I think we saw that, you know, Judy Cameron, one of our senior captains, first woman pilot at Air Canada, she actually just won the Order of Canada. She was featured recently on the CBC. I shared that article with you and she's talking about some of her challenges. Again, as a woman, I think there's, you know, less than 200. The number is probably a little bit higher now out of over 5,000 pilots are women. And she was number one. So the look she got in the cafeteria when she walked in that first day in her uniform, you know, she remembers that to this day, how that, that feels. So, and that's not anybody, you know, calling her out. It's them just being in shock or not welcoming her the way they would, you know, another pilot that looks exactly like they do. So, yeah, I think there's a ton of work to do and, it's happening, but I think for most people it's probably not happening quick enough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great point. We talked about, last time we were talking about, COVID and what it was like to kind of fly during that time. And I'm just wondering, like, would you say things have kind of recovered from post COVID, and particularly I kind of want your thoughts on, if there's been any sort of like brain drain, I guess, in the industry, because things kind of shut down, did people kind of move on? I know on the pilot side, like you said, there's not really a big pool there, but has there kind of been this brain drain in the industry at all? Do you know?
There has, I think, in some of the other jobs at our airline. Mm. Again, because of the seniority system, because of the way that the profession is structured in Canada, most people came back to their jobs. There were a small number that got recruited into the U.S. So if you had U.S. citizenship, the salaries tend to be quite a bit higher right now in the U.S., which is something that, you know, our pilot group is trying to address. But aside from those few people that left to go pursue, you know, jobs in the U.S., we have most of our crews come back on the line. If anything, it's back full tilt. There's so much flying and so much demand that any drain that would be there would just be we're using all of our crews and our aircraft on existing routes. We've had to pull back on some of our thinner routes. I was just in the Hawaiian Islands, and it looks like we're pulling out of Maui for the summer, which has traditionally been a route that we've done year round. So examples like that's where we're seeing some of the pressure is the recovery is going so quickly, catching up on training, getting everybody back online takes time. That's where the gap is right now for pilots. I think service agents, maybe flight attendants. Yeah, we definitely lost some folks in that realm. But most people, I think, still view the airlines in Canada as a good job that they would want to come back to. And that's what we're seeing. Yeah.
Is the demand on pilots right now really, really high? Like, how are you folks finding work-life balance, I guess?
For the line pilot, it's so structured, right? We have, you know, a maximum amount of hours that we can fly during the month. All of our training is laid out in front of us. I think the people that are most busy are the people that, because the airline's growing, that are getting promoted, are upgrading to captain or upgrading to a larger aircraft. That training can be demanding, and it's you know, there's not a lot of breaks. So for the people that are in the training process, you know, it's helpful if you've got a good partner to support you through that, and if you've got children, you know what it's like. There's a lot of single parenting going on because the other person's in the books or in the simulator or potentially in another city. Yeah. So that's hard on folks.
Yeah.
Usually that's limited to about 2 or 3 months. Okay. That's what it takes to sort of get qualified on a new fleet type, not to get a license. That's many years, but we get all our licenses and then we're trained specifically on one aircraft type.
Yeah.
Last
time we also talked about, you said that those pilots who have training and those kind of really short flights where they're kind of flying through like rigorous terrain and you said, man, those guys have amazing training. I remember, I don't know if I told you this story, like when we were in Hawaii flying from Maui to Molokai, 9-seater little plane, I was scared as hell, man. Like I thought like that plane was bumping all over the place. But those pilots are so skilled, like they know how to fly with the winds and just they have so much experience. And I remember you saying like, yeah, they have amazing training. Like, do you think you would be able to kind of like, I guess if you were to fly one of those kind of small planes again, like, would that be a different experience or would that kind of be easy for you?
That's the hardest flying, certainly in Canada. Okay. When we look at the folks that are flying those small 9-seaters, 9 to 20-seaters, they're up in the Arctic. They're going into the most challenging airports. So no air traffic control. They're on their own for their own terrain and clearance with other aircraft. They're flying in ice, rain, snow, blizzard conditions. And they're really, some of them are on their own. A lot of them have a co-pilot. So it's an extremely challenging environment and a lot of them are working many days in a row. So it's definitely a better suited to someone younger who may have more energy for it. For me to go back, you know, in my mid-40s, definitely I would want, you know, some serious time to get comfortable again in that type of aircraft and that type of environment. It's not something that you can just jump right into. So yeah, I have a lot of respect for those folks. And some people do it for their whole career. And those are the people that can mentor the younger pilots coming up through that that pathway. And I would say that the airlines are still looking for bush pilots as to build their pilot corps. Because it's right up there with military as far as good experience and, you know, call it hard time. It is very difficult flying.
Is there still a thrill for you? Like whether it be like, what is the thrill for you right now? Like, is it a new type of aircraft? Is it like, I don't know, what is the certain routes?
Yeah, there's
like,
always the challenge. New aircraft, new routes are for any pilot is that you get excited about. I'm going to, you know, take on this new challenge and learn a new aircraft, or I'm going to an airport that I haven't been to before. I think all of us like the exercise of getting in the books. When you're flying overseas and you haven't been to, you know, one of our overseas destinations in a while, or sometimes it's your first time in, it can be days of review before, leading up to that trip to make sure that you're current. So that's the challenging part. If you want the part that gets me, you know, smiling in my seat, it's, you know, sunset into Honolulu and, you know, light breeze coming off the ocean and you can see the surf rolling in and click off all the automation and it's just you in the airplane. You can really feel what it's doing, carve it around on the approach and really try and get that nice smooth arrival into the Hawaiian Islands. That's very satisfying and still just as fun as it was, you know, 25 years ago when I started flying.
Yeah. If there's a new route, like you said, you're starting to prep, like what does that prep look like? Are you like, would there be simulator training on that? Or like, what would the prep
look like? There can be. Some of our more niche destinations require a special qualification. Mm. And we kind of rank our airports in that regard. So most of the more challenging airports is a review by the captain and the crew. So we would sit with our documents at home, look at the terrain around the airport, look at special procedures. Some of the airports have terrain that we've got to make sure the aircraft performance can meet. So it would be, you know, studying for an exam. You're going through all the material and making sure that you're ready to have the answers for anything that might pop up. I'd be reviewing, you know, the frequencies and the layout of the airport so that when we land, I'm familiar with where I'm supposed to taxi. And then we've got a number of documents that we'd be looking at. So the airport maps themselves, we've got route manuals. So we can go in and look at what's specific to this airport, what are the alternate airports around that. And then we'd go in and look at, okay, what are the procedures to get into this region that I'm not familiar with? Sometimes we're flying in feet, sometimes we're flying in meters. There's all kinds of communication protocols when we're flying over the ocean. Different regions have different rules, so you're reviewing those. And like I said, it can take a, you know, couple of afternoons of serious work just to get ready to do that trip. So you know, pilots don't get paid for that. It's part of our maintaining our professional qualifications.
Toughest airport you've flown into?
You know, there's, you know, on my current fleet, Santa Ana down in California can be challenging. It's Orange County. It's sort of southeast of Los Angeles. It's a very popular destination because Disneyland is right there. So a lot of families coming in. And it's a challenging airport because the runway is extremely short. It can have some winds and some turbulence coming into the airport. And it's also, we share that airport with the general aviation community. So they do flight training and private ownership out of that aircraft, out of that airport. So you could be on final right next to a light piston aircraft who, you know, this, it's a student pilot doing their first solo. So your heightened awareness, you're outside and you're ready to make a very smooth but short firm landing into Orange County. So for the MAX out of Vancouver, that's a challenging airport. Globally, you know, we do go into South America and some of those airports can be very challenging because of the terrain around, different procedures, and globally, you know, English is the language of aviation. But you want to be really precise with your communications and making sure that you're really listening in, communicating well with other aircraft. So it's just having that, you know, that good rest beforehand and making sure that you're ready to be, you know, on point the whole 15-hour flight that you're going into this airport. So
I've seen these sometimes these spats, I don't know, between air traffic control and pilots. Have you run into that? And if, like, who, like, I guess air traffic control, are they pretty much the governors of everything? Like, you got to listen to them or
yeah, they are. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, look, if it's unsafe, we're not going to do it. We'll just say we're unable. That's all you have to say to air traffic control. If they give you a direction that you can't comply with safely, you just said, look, you know, Vancouver Tower, we're unable at this time, request alternate instructions. All of the communications globally now, you can listen to live online pretty much. I mean, I'm sure there's some frequencies that you might not be able to, but if you want to listen to live ATC feeds from any of the major airports, you can just search that online and you can sit and listen to arriving traffic into, you know, Calgary, Edmonton, Vancouver, Atlanta, wherever you want. So I think folks are kind of waiting for some kind of moment. when the weather's bad and, you know, there's delays and maybe the airport's shut down for a time, you're low on fuel. Yeah, definitely the stress starts to build. You might be at the end of a long day. The controller might be at the end of their day. Any experience I've had is total professionalism. But yeah, occasionally, like any job, tensions can kind of come out on the radio, and I've heard those recordings, but I actually haven't encountered it, you know, too much in real life. I think, you know, occasionally I've been in New York, can be a tough airport, LaGuardia can to fly into, because it's such a tight little airport, no space to maneuver. There can be dozens of airplanes waiting to take off and land, and there's crossing runways. So you're zipping across a runway, someone's landing behind you, you're queuing up to take off, and you've just, again, got to be really hyper aware of what's going on around you. And if there's unexpected delays or problems, or you get your takeoff clearance canceled for some reason, and you're running down on fuel, that means you may have to go back to the gate and your day just got a whole lot longer. So I think sometimes you can hear all of that come out on the radio. But there's so few instances of it. I think that's why it makes such a, you know, salacious post on social media. Hey, check out these pilots and controllers going at each other. Very uncommon. I haven't heard anything. And it's to the point where I'm like, well, I don't know if this is real or not. But, you know, I assume they grabbed it off some feed somewhere.
It makes it sound like there's chaos in the skies, right? Like whenever you see these kind of posts. So.
Right. And I think that's where, you know, from the flight deck perspective, you know, going back to our initial conversation, whether it's a safety issue, an emergency that's happened, that's been publicized, or one of these, you know, very unusual spats between two professionals on the radio, that of course it happens, you know, thousands of flights every day, millions of flight hours every year. Yes, someone's going to lose their cool. Does it lead to an accident? Certainly not. And the accidents that do happen, they need to be looked at and considered, but they're beyond infrequent. It's it's like, you know, black swan event kind of thing.
Yeah.
So that's how most of us look at it. But I know the public might think that that's how we talk to each other, but it's not. And in fact, you know, the controllers are so cool. You can ask them to repeat the same clearance 10 times and they'll give it to you exactly the same tone, same tenor. You know, it's like you're asking for the first time. That's their job, is to stay cool.
I feel like the aviation airline industry is just one of those industries that, again, the general public just, it seems like a black box, even though, like, you know, it's awesome. I didn't even know that you could listen to any sort of ATC feed of any major airport. That's pretty cool. But it just seems like it's this black box. So then people kind of assume that, you know, make all these assumptions, or they hear these kind of clips or whatever, and it's like they freak out, right? And they feel like things are out of order or whatever. But everything that I always hear from out of your mouth, it just feels like everything is very orderly, very purposeful, so much training behind things, a lot of checklists. Like it's in some degree, it's kind of like boring in some ways. It's like these
we want it to be boring.
You want it to be boring. We do, right?
We want, and I think we're victims of our own success in that way, in that when things do happen, there's they become a big deal because they're so infrequent. Mm-hmm. Often we'll say it's after 9/11 when that flight deck was locked, we lost some of that connection with the public where we couldn't mm-hmm. show them what an average day for an airline pilot looks like, which is really interesting, and it's a great job, but it's not the Tom Cruise flying upside down, everything's a panic, Top Gun. It's very methodical and procedural, and it's the interesting part is the technology and the destinations and where we're going and how we're going to get there. It's not that there's, we're running around with emergency bells going off and all the rest of it. So yeah, that's certainly, I think, where the public is getting a little bit of whiplash with some of the news coming out of whether it's Boeing or these ATC feeds or whatever. Yeah. Is this system still safe? So, from our perspective as pilots, it is, but there's constant work to keep it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, back to the Boeing discussion, that's really, I think, where the FAA is looking, is to say, you've had a couple of these red flags come up. Obviously, the crashes with MCAS and the initial issues with the MAX were catastrophic. That should have been enough of a wake-up call. And then this most recent one, some of the comments coming out of the FAA are is like, this shouldn't have happened, and it can't happen again. When you get the regulator using that kind of language, they're going to take some serious steps, and they're actually they're intervening in production now, which is I'm not sure that's ever happened before. They're not approving an expansion in production on that aircraft because of this issue. So it's going to be interesting to watch what happens at Boeing, because they, for better or for worse, they're going to have to make some fundamental changes to get the public confidence back. That's a whole other conversation, but yeah, it's significant because they've taken something that's supposed to be boring and safe and made it captured the public's attention.
It's like trust is being danced on a knife's edge, right? Like it's just one instance or whatever, and it's just you're on the other side. Whereas like for the most part, you're kind of just teetering there, and it's like, okay, everything's safe, and one little thing happens and,
Yeah. And it's tough to have the conversation that we're having, which is, no, the system is still there. And I think equally, you don't want to dismiss that these are significant issues. The rapid depressurization, that's an emergency that we train for that, but we assume it's not going to happen. And it happened. This isn't some random failure. You can trace it back to something that happened on the production floor, and then it's attached to a manufacturer that's had other issues. So the question is, what slice of cheese are we looking at in our Swiss cheese model? And we've got to take that safety barrier and really look at why are there so many holes, or why are there threats getting through this layer of safety? We thought, after the MCAS issues and the initial rollout of the MAX, that there would have been change, and now we're getting suggestions that there hasn't been changes at Boeing. I don't know if you got a chance to look at any of the stuff that I sent your way as far as some of the history there, but it's a company culture issue, it seems. And, it can be traced back as far as like the 90s when they merged with McDonnell Douglas. Mm-hmm. Some of the analysis that I've seen is the culture at the board of directors level could be one of the things they're going to have to look at. The makeup of that board. I thought it was surprising that, for an aviation manufacturer, how few folks on that board of director were engineering or safety focused. There's a lot of like former, I think there's a White House chief of staff. There's some
former ambassador to the United States, Miss Nikki Haley, was on the board. Haley who was on the board? Yeah.
I didn't know it was Nikki Haley. I just knew it was a former U.S. ambassador. So that's where you're. There you go. Okay. So not that Nikki Haley doesn't care about safety, but you know, part of the board, any board of directors' job is to look at risk. Mm-hmm. And if you're manufacturing airplanes, you do have to understand something about the risk of building an aircraft in a sort of global sense, I guess. So again, this is all just initial stuff that's been published. I think mm-hmm. there's going to be a lot more to read. So it's all speculation at this point. But, you know, I think what has been documented is old company had a real engineering and safety focus in the past. Something happened. Maybe mm-hmm. it's the merger with McDonnell Douglas. Maybe it's, you know, some people point to when they moved their head office to Chicago, ostensibly for tax purposes. You're manufacturing in Seattle, but you're based in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There's a disconnect between the leadership and the production floor. There's sort of a lot of speculation at this point, but the FAA will have to conclude their investigation and really look at, okay, here's what has to change at Boeing after these multiple unrelated issues. That's probably where the conversation's at as far as flying the aircraft. Like I said, there's a lot of layers of safety between manufacturing aircraft and actually hopping in and taking off. And yeah, unfortunately, that one threat at Alaska did get through all of those layers. Mm-hmm. And it's a very unlikely event, but the pilot's training, you know, that was one of those last layers, very stressful event, but they got back on the ground safely because of that.
You would think with all this, Boeing is in trouble, but then you also said something really interesting, and I don't know if this still makes sense, given that you said that maybe there's a bit of a reduction of the expansion of production. But you said that when they went from the 737 to the 737 MAX, there was an Airbus competitor, but the great thing about it being the reason why there was an adoption of the 737 MAX was that you didn't have to go through all that extra certification. There was kind of this easier transition for crews to make to be able to fly the 737 MAX. Do you think that still makes sense today with the troubles that Boeing is having? Like if Airbus right now, I would imagine is probably like, man, this is like a great opportunity for us to continue to increase our market share, because they have been, right? Like I think they're still the dominant player in the industry, but this is probably another great opportunity for them to take even more market share. But would that do you think that would be the case? Do you think Boeing's in big trouble right now? Or
I think Boeing's in big trouble, but I know that for the global demand that's out there with two manufacturers, Airbus cannot meet the global demand for new aircraft. So if I was Airbus, I would be, you know, maybe somewhat optimistic that I could increase sales. But I think in a broader sense, I'd be concerned that A, Boeing's tarnishing the reputation of the aviation system. Mm-hmm. And B, you know, even if we, you know, ramp up production to produce the maximum amount of aircraft every month, we're still not going to be able to make up for the demand that's out there globally. So Boeing and Airbus are... they're in it together, whether they like it or not. And I think it's in everybody's interest for Boeing to, you know, radically reform themselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that looks like. The FAA is stepping in and limiting production. That sends a signal for sure. I don't think the public necessarily understands what that means, but that's, you know, essentially nationalizing the production at Boeing, saying the public's now going to have control of how many airplanes you produce every month. That's shocking. So, you know, I don't think there's a party at Airbus. Certainly they are taking orders and filling their order book, but that's years down the road.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to mean more money in Airbus's pocket necessarily, but yeah, whatever happens, Boeing's got to fix their issues. As far as the certification, you know, the MAX still had to be certified as a new aircraft type. What I was referring to is more the pilot training. Sold it to companies as you don't need to offer new training to your pilots in the simulator. They can hop in and fly this. It's similar enough to the existing model. And there's issues with that. They now with those accidents and the MCAS system that got so much attention, they did have to go back and do simulator training for those pilots. And we received training on that aircraft specifically, but we only fly the one type. So we weren't flying multiple variants of the 737.
Yeah. Yeah. It's too bad there's no other major manufacturer. I feel like a long time ago, maybe there was hope for, like, in the Canadian aerospace sense when, you know, the Avro Aero was out there. And
that was just a
disaster. I'm so disappointed in that, by the way. Like, it just that Diefenbaker canceled that project. Like, I feel like because we lost so much of our talent to the United States after that. And we could have been this major powerhouse when it comes to aerospace. Like, it's.
Unfortunately, I think we're always living in the shadow of the U.S. in that regard. I mean, we did produce recently it was called the C series, which was Bombardier produced a single aisle jet to compete with the 737. It's a little bit smaller than a 737, but it has a similar range profile. Mm. And, there was a lot of resistance in the U.S. to allowing that aircraft into their country without serious tariffs, which that meant, you know, there had to be a partnership with Airbus to make that happen. So now it's an Airbus 220. It really is a Canadian designed and built aircraft. Okay. But it became difficult to export into the U.S. And, you know, maybe it was politics, who knows, but they ended up having to sell the program to Airbus in order to get a foothold into the U.S. market. So now Delta operates at Breeze, I think JetBlue, but I'm not sure. But there is a market for it. We operate them. I think we have as many as 50 or 60 on order. Currently, I think there's around 30 in the fleet. So we're flying a Canadian designed jet. It's just difficult, apparently, to make a go of it as a Canadian aerospace manufacturer.
Yeah.
It hasn't always been successful. So I think that's where you do get you do come up against politics. But, you know, Bombardier has produced a lot of great airplanes over the years, the Dash 8, the RJ, the 220, which is formerly the C series. And then certainly the Avro project was pretty inspiring. That could have been an amazing interceptor aircraft. It was before it was destroyed.
If it was just destroyed based on like finance, I don't even exactly know what the main reason was, but I think finance, it was a very expensive project. And I think finances were a consideration.
Yeah, I think the engine
go ahead.
The engine development lagged a little bit. But I mean, there's plenty of, I'm not an Avro expert. I know that there was a desire to sell a missile system to Canada as a alternative to developing an interceptor. And that probably played a part. And I think these decisions are made outside of the aviation industry. They're made, in government.
Yeah.
And we all know how complicated that could be.
Yeah, for sure. What else is on your mind on this space before we kind of jump a little bit into, I know we're going to save our big politics conversation for when we see each other, but.
Let's save it. I think this was sort of top of mind because we wanted to tackle some of the aviation stuff. I'm not currently involved anymore in the labor sphere, but I do observe it, and our airlines and other airlines, certainly labor groups are negotiating. And I think there's expectations haven't changed since we last spoke, but I think, we're going to see some tough bargaining ahead. I can't comment obviously because I'm not involved anymore and we haven't concluded bargaining, but our group is in mediation currently to get a collective agreement. WestJet just signed their agreement with some wage gains, upwards of 20%. And we're seeing really significant contract gains in the US as well. So I think a lot of professions, a lot of workers in general have high expectations. And I think the question is, can these employers meet where their employees are at without conflict? And that'll be interesting to see. So the next time we talk, we might have more to say on that front.
Yeah.
But right now it's sort of wait and see as far as the labor world goes, certainly at Air Canada, but, more broadly, I think, anybody who's bargaining right now is hoping the economy stays in recovery mode, that people are still keen on flying, which it doesn't seem like that's pulling back anytime soon.
No. General question as a former union labor leader, I'm sure this is not the first time you've heard this, but Elon Musk was recently said, because there's a lot of talk about unionization at Tesla and some of his companies. And he says, you know, he feels that if unionization were to happen, that he's kind of failed as a leader to be able to provide the conditions, the right working conditions and compensation or whatever, you know, people are looking for. I mean, I think in principle, that makes a lot of sense. But like, what's your reaction to that kind of talk?
Yeah, I mean, this is always the debate is like, look, I'm a great employer. We don't need a union. And that sort of assumes that, you know, I'm benevolent enough and I have enough of wherewithal to know what you want. I think the flip side of that coin is in any business, the owners hold all the cards. So even if you're a great boss and you're willing to open up your pockets to the employees have less power in that dynamic. And I think anybody who's looking at just big picture unionism, where there's business, there should be unions, because as a union, certainly in North America, the US and Canada, you have all these rights. So you have the right to grieve, you know, something that happens to you at work. You have the right to bargain collectively and use the bargaining tools, whether that's mediation, conciliation, job action, strike, lock, and equally the employer can lock their employees out. So it gives you that framework. And it could be as simple as something like, you didn't fulfill this part of my contract. You know, you think you did. I don't think you did. Let's go through the grievance process and settle the dispute. So it's not even the big bargaining stuff that always makes the news. It's just the basic protections that the labor code offers you, right? So it would be like going to work without a healthcare plan. That's my basic view. Of course, collective bargaining is what everybody pays attention to. I think it's a different kind of workplace. If you're going to have a collective agreement with your employees, you're not going to have the high performers or the people that are closest to management get the best benefits and the most money. You're just going to have to pay everybody per the collective agreement. Doesn't mean you can't reward people for great performance, but it has to be within that document. And I think that's where companies, tech companies in particular, don't love the idea of a collective agreement. For airline pilots, it makes it a very level playing field. I don't have to worry about making sure that I have to make a decision between pushing on time and making sure that I'll get all my checklists done or that we're safe to fly. Well, of course, I'm going to make the safety decision first. Obviously, I want to do both. I want to push on time and be safe, but I don't have to make that safety decision to please my boss to make sure that my pay stays at a certain level. And I think equally, when you look at SpaceX, it's in that same sphere. You could make the argument that for your engineers and your technicians, if you are under a collective agreement, they might be more focused on safety. You know, SpaceX is trying to blaze some new trails. It's probably still run very much like a tech company. So I can see why he doesn't want a collective agreement there. It can really slow things down. My argument is you're going to have a safer workplace that's more sustainable. I keep doing the callback to Boeing. You know, Boeing moved a lot of their production to right to work state without unionized employees. I don't think there's enough information to draw a line between unionization and the production line, and some of the issues that we're seeing with Boeing aircraft. But I think it's widely accepted that Seattle, which was the unionized production plant, was the more experienced plant. And maybe if you did some digging, you could look at what the quality differences are. But I hadn't seen anything that had made that connection yet. I just know that for employees, it's going to create, it's going to give them a lot more protections. So when they're prioritizing things in their head, safety might live higher up than worrying about, am I going to get fired for this? Or am I going to not get my raise for this decision that I'm making?
Yeah. Well, look, my friend, this is time always flies by when I chat with you.
I know, that was quick.
it was really quick. First time I looked at the clock was at like 45 minutes. I'm like, holy shit, this is an awesome conversation.
Another hour and a half or.
Yeah, it's always fun to talk to you. You always bring great logics and sense to the conversation and kind of, just kind of square everything up for people in a really easy, digestible way. So I'm sure people are going to find this really useful. Look forward to seeing you this summer, and we're going to talk more about a whole bunch of things. And anytime
we're going to open up the conversation. We won't record that one.
No, that one won't be recorded. It'll be off the record. Nice. always enjoy talking to you. You're welcome back anytime. And thanks for making time for me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rupesh. Look forward to it. I'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good. Thanks, everyone, for joining in. Like, subscribe, do all those wonderful things, and we'll see you in the next episode. Cheers.